This is Jennifer Dupre interviewing Harold Fisher, July the 6th, 1989.
I'm Harold Fisher, and where do you want me to start, Jennifer?
Okay, first, how old are you?
I'm 65 years old.
Okay, and let's start with your family history. You indicated that you had both sides of your family in this area around the 1850s.
That's correct, yeah. Both, we might start on my father's side with the name Fisher. My great-grandfather, Abram Fisher, was one of three brothers. We're assuming that he was probably the youngest one, who sailed their own fishing boat. They were fishermen in the Netherlands, so the name comes rightly. And they sailed their own fishing boat across the Atlantic. And we learned from one of the relatives that they had some record of it, that it took them 90 days to get here. Somehow on the way, he stopped and was married in Buffalo, New York. There again, we're making some assumptions. We think probably that was an old girlfriend that he had known, and did marry her in Buffalo, and then they traveled on up through the lakes and got up to the Wisconsin side of Lake Michigan, did some fishing there, and then they came back, came over to the Grand Haven side around 1853.
Who did he bring with him? Brothers?
Just those two brothers, as far as we know, but evidently his wife and there was a child that was born prior to the marriage, about 1 year prior to the marriage. So that was the oldest son. He did have the name of Fisher. Whether my great-grandfather just kind of automatically adopted him or what happened there, we don't really know. But there was the oldest child. And he eventually left and went back over to Kenosha when he got in his teens. He left and went over with one of the uncles that stayed over there. There is a portion of our family that goes back over onto the Wisconsin side. One of those brothers evidently stayed over there. But Abram, or Brumos, as he was known, that's how the family knew him and friends knew him, did settle here in Grand Haven, and he started the first commercial fishing business in Grand Haven. They had some property that they acquired, roughly about 80 acres on the opposite side of the river. And it was a large triangular piece where the part of the musical fountain and the boat marine docks that are over there, those are all located on that shoreline. But they were over there. There was actually a trio of men that formed a fishing corporation or fishing company over there, and it was called Fisher, Van Zanten, and Obeck. And those are some familiar names that have been around here for a long time, too. Eventually, the Van Zantens and the Obeck dropped out of the business, and my great-grandfather continued to operate that practically up until the time when he died. He was in his 70s, I believe, when he died. And he had been quite a community-minded person. He was very active in his church activities, as were most of our relatives and most of the Hollanders that came over that time. There were many churches formed by the various Hollanders, as you can see from the Reformed and Christian Reformed. He was in one of the original families that started the first Christian, or second Christian Reformed church.
That
one is located now down on Robbins Road and Sheldon.
Did they move it?
They went with us. There was a split in the First Reformed Church at that time, and they went with the minister who formed the Second Christian Reformed Church. As I remember as a boy, that church was mostly located in the area where the parking lot for the community center is now, right across from the old city hall, or the old fire station. That was the Second Christian Reformed Church. Excuse me. Let's see. On his death, his sons took over the fishing business and operated it for some years after that. They decided quite early in the stages after the sons took over the business there were three brothers that were operating together. One of them, my grandfather, John, and his other two brothers persuaded him to put his house in hock and buy a new tug, and they had one built by the Johnson Boiler over in Ferrysburg. And it was named the A. Fisher in honor of their father, who had then passed away. And the A. Fisher at that time was probably one of the prize tugs on the river, although there were several of them like it. If you look at some of the pictures in the museum of the various fish tugs, you'll see a lot of boats that look very similar to the A. Fisher.
Do you know about how much that cost?
No, I don't. I don't know. But I know they put their house in hock, and then the fishing business went bad, and my grandmother and grandfather ended up having to repurchase their home on Fulton Street. Okay. I know that as a matter of fact. But about
what year did the fishing business what?
Oh, I would say it was probably in the late teens, probably about 1919, 1920, right in there, that the fishing business went. Belly up. The tug, I can tell you, it was new in 1910, because the postcard picture of it that I gave to the museum was a postcard that was sent by my father when he was 12 years old. He was born in 1898, and that was sent to a cousin in Grand Rapids, and that family somehow or other eventually gave him the postcard back years later. And it had a real good picture of the tug on it, and Dewey Hill in the background. At that time, in that picture, if you ever dig it out, you can see that there were still some telephone poles standing on the Dewey Hill side of the river, because that's where the original rail station was over there. The railroad yard used to go over on that side of the river before they built the bridge across Grand River. But you can see in 1910 those telephone poles were still standing and were showing on that side of the river. That's kind of interesting. And the hill is only about half the height of what it is now. In 1910, that hill was that much lower. It built itself up with the dune shifting, and it's much taller now than what it was then. Let's go over that gives you some of the history, you know, some of the things that I know of the Fisher side. My grandfather remained here after the fishing business went belly up. Why, then he worked for a while as a fireman. He was a fireman with the department in the city of Grand Haven. There are some pictures in the city hall that have him in the old fire department way back when they had horse-drawn fire engines.
Did you ever tell you any stories?
No, I never knew too much about that until after my grandfather had died, so I never knew too much about that. I can remember that after his stint with the fire department, then he went to work for the piano factory. And he had an accident at the piano factory and then never worked after that. But that was pretty much his history. My father, Abram, was the oldest son of John Fisher. And he was a long-time active church member again. As you know, that just kind of carried down through the family. In the First Reformed Church, and most of my boyhood days, what I remember of my father as a young boy was how much he was active in the church and in the community too. Dad used to, as I mentioned to you a little time before, he served for over 30 years as a member of that advisory board of the Salvation Army. He was a long-time member of the Duncan Park Board. And uh, uh, He also served on the cemetery board for a while too, for the city of Grand Haven.
What did he do?
My dad was a bookkeeper, accountant, and eventually became the treasurer of Michigan Brass Corporation. He worked for a number of years. As I was a boy, he worked for the old Dake Engine Company, which was located down near the river on Beacon Boulevard. And he was the bookkeeper and the paymaster and that type, that held that kind of a job for Dake Engine, until that was purchased by the Jacobsons and Johnsons, eventually to become JSJ. And they still have Dake Corporation, which maintains that name. The old Dake Engine Company, in its early days, that was known for making hoist engines for ships, the cargo hoist engine. And it was a square piston that they built, and they still maintained parts for that for years after that, because those engines were so good and so reliable. All they needed were sometimes new pistons or new rods or something like that. But they were made out of, there was a lot of cast iron in there, and they used to do a lot of foundry work. And I can remember as a boy, my dad would tell me on the days when they were going to be pouring, and I'd go down and watch them, and I'd watch them cast all that hot metal. You know, it was quite an experience. But the foundry was located way in the back end on the river side back there. But I used to watch them do that. And then they also made cast steering wheels for ships. They were related to the shipbuilding business quite closely at that time. And so it was an interesting old plant that existed here. Had a long, long history in Grand Haven. But Dad left there after the Jacobsons and Johnsons purchased that company. Then Dad left and went to what was then known as American Brass Novelty, and eventually became Michigan Brass.
Yeah.
And were located up on the waterfront, and it was always a lot of fun when Dad would come home from work at night, and he could tell you every ship that came in the harbor. On winter days, he'd talk about the fact that fish tugs went out on cold, blustery, stormy days. He'd tell about watching the fish tugs leave and go out into the lake, disappear in between the waves, and he'd think they were never coming up again, but he'd watch them get out the harbor. And then maybe late in the afternoon, well, he'd see them come back in, but he'd always track many of those boats in and out of the harbor. And as a boy, he used to work on his father's and grandfather's tugs. And so he was familiar with some of that work in there and the amount of work. Never was interested in getting into the fishing business. Yeah, but he always liked the river. I guess I wrote down I was born as the second son to Abram. Had an older brother, Russell, and a sister, Elsa. And I'm the kind of the black sheep of the family that kept track of the family history, I guess. My sister is interested in it, but more from the standpoint that one of her daughters is very interested. So all the information I found on the family, I've passed on to her, and she always passes it on to her daughter. But they're no longer, none of them are any longer in the community. My sister is over in Midland. My brother passed away about 2 years ago. So we're kind of holding down the fort here in Grand Haven. I still have an aunt, Elizabeth Fisher, who is my father's younger sister, and then he has a brother, Raymond, who is still living. He was the youngest in the family. Raymond used to work for the Grand Haven Tribune. My Aunt Elizabeth worked for the Coast Guard for a number of years, and then for the old Challenge Machinery. My Aunt Elizabeth is in her 80s now, but still very, very sharp, and I would recommend that if you wanted a good interview, get a hold of her.
Okay.
You could find out some interesting information from her, too. She could tell you a lot about the activities of the old Coast Guard, what they call it, I think it was the 10th District or 12th District office that was up in the post office building. That's where she started working for them. And then went on when they moved that office to Chicago. She went over there until she retired from the Coast Guard. But she would be a good contact for you to make as well. Now, let's jump over to the other side of the family, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay. My great-grandfather, Albers, was a painter and decorator, and he came, that family came over from the Netherlands with, I think it was the second trip that Reverend Van Ralty made over to the Netherlands and back with a whole group of Holland people to bring them over into the Holland area. But there are some Albers that are still in the Holland area that are related. Some of them kind of migrated on up to Muskegon. But my great-grandfather located here in Grand Haven and set up a painting and decorating business. He was located in their first home here that we know of was a home that's still standing on Clinton Street. I can't give you the exact address. I could at some time later on, but that house on Clinton Street was a little bungalow type of home. And then eventually he purchased property from Nathaniel Slayton on 3rd Street, which was eventually, the address was 114 South 3rd. That property was just in the last few years sold by me to the National Bank of Detroit, where they built their branch office there and their drive-in bank on 3rd and Clinton, but it's now a parking lot for that bank, that piece of property.
Where was the house moved to?
That house was moved off there. It was one of the few that the bank acquired that they actually moved. I guess it was the only one they actually moved. Yeah, they sold that, and it was moved to 6th Street down behind the Rendezvous restaurant. And in a complex of a number of older homes that were all moved in there, and now called, I think he calls it the Old Town Apartments, that there's about five homes in there that he has remodeled and made into a very nice apartment building.
The bank?
No, the gentleman who bought it from the bank.
Oh, yeah. I see.
But he had the houses moved and then reconditioned them. Although I was in that home last summer, and it is very, very similar to the way it was when I owned it. Two apartments. It was actually built originally as a two-apartment home because when my great-grandfather built it, part of the family lived upstairs, and he and his wife lived downstairs, and eventually they switched. And the grandmother and grandfather went up, and my grandparents were downstairs. It was a family home, and they had the lot next door, which was their paint shop. And I have a picture of that, as I showed you, showing the old property back in 1882. That house, I might tell you a little bit about it as to how it was built. It was built during the latter part of the big lumbering days here. And so there was a lot of good white pine available. And that house and its construction, and I've been all over it through the attic. I've torn some walls out and replaced windows and so on, so I know how the house was built. It actually was built on 10 by 10 pine a pine frame of 10 by 10 logs.
Okay.
And as a foundation on the brick for the basement. And those 10 by 10 frames kind of wove themselves in about 3-4 different places through the house to take care of the stress point. So it was a very well, the foundation was very well built, which made it very easy for them to move without doing any damage to the home. Studs on that house going up the sides are all full 2-inch by 4-inch rough cut pine, white pine. And then the exterior was covered with full 1-inch rough cut white pine boards, some of them with hardly a knot in them, that were as wide as 22 inches and full 1-inch thick. And then on the inside of that 2x4 frame was another 3/4-inch layer of white pine, of rough-cut white pine. So any time you drilled through from one side, from the inside or outside of that house to get through a wall, you had to go through all that white pine, and it was just beautiful lumber. I've done some wiring in there, and
well, it was kind of soft.
Yeah, it was fun to work on the house because it was so well built, and anything that you, anytime we went into a wall or broke into a wall or something like that, why it was kind of fun to get in there just to see how well built it was. Then on the inside of that 3/4-inch was all the plaster lath, mm-hmm. and then plaster on top of that. So the house was pretty well insulated just with the amount of lumber they put on that thing. Yeah. You can imagine the weight of it when they moved it down the street, when you think of a full two-story.
I wonder how many trees that took.
Not too many. They cut a few branches down, but they didn't have to remove too many trees. The only real nice tree that they removed out of there was one in the front yard. That was a beautiful maple.
I mean how many trees it took to build the house.
Oh, how many trees it took to build a house. Oh, I would guess there was a pretty good-sized piece of land that gave up a lot of white pine in order to build that. Yeah. It was a very well-built home, or is a very well-built home, and I, barring any catastrophe, that's going to last a long time yet.
Yeah.
Because there were two beautiful apartments. The upstairs apartment was 3-bedroom, and the downstairs apartment was 2 bedrooms. And it was a very, big. It was a 32-by-32-foot house, so there was a lot of floor space in there. It was a nice piece of property, and I'm real glad to see that, the bank did not destroy it.
Yes.
As they had to do with some of the other ones that were not as well built. But that homestead remained in the family. My grandfather, Henry Albers, was one of 3 sons. There was Marinus, who was born in the Netherlands, and he came over as a small boy, and then my grandfather was born here in the States, and as was an Uncle Fred, who located right across the street. That house is still standing, the one that Uncle Fred had built. It was built a little later, but very well built, kind of Victorian-style home. It's a beautiful home. I think the address is 115 South 3rd. And a member of the family still lives in there, my mother's cousin, Julia Joldersma. She married a John Joldersma. She lives in that home yet. And that home is still pretty much the way it was when it was built. Nothing really was changed too much in that home. And I can remember the last time I was in it, the oak floors, the oak, large oak woodwork, oak doors, a beautiful oak staircase going upstairs. That's a beautiful home, and someday that could be made into a very nice showpiece. As far as an antique or home of the late 1800s, early 1900s. That's about when it was built. But it's very much in the same state it was when it was built. I don't think Julia has changed it to speak of at all. She was born in that home, I think, and she's still there. And she's, wow. I think she's, I talked to her, one of her nephews, or a girl that married a nephew of hers, just yesterday, and I think she told me she's 88 years old. And she's still living in that home. Yeah, her husband just died 2 years ago. So but that's an interesting place.
Do you think she would be interested in the interview?
She may. I don't know. I haven't talked much to her in the last year or two. I haven't really seen her to talk to. But she may be interested in telling you a few things. She could tell you things about probably about her childhood. Her father lived to be very close to 100. He just about made 100 years old. But I can remember him telling tales. He went to grade school in the first school building that was built in Grand Haven on Clinton Street. There was a school on Clinton and First, I think it was. Either Clinton and First or Clinton Second, but over in that area. And it was an old slabwood school that was built over there, and he used to tell us when he was a boy that they would be frightened sometimes when the Indians would come up Grand River, into Grand River. They'd come down the Muskegon River and canoe down into the Grand River, and then they would plant corn where that boat marina is now. That was just a kind of a river flat muckland area.
Yeah.
That was down below the sand dunes, and they would plant corn in there, and while the parents were over there planting corn, the Indian children would canoe across the river, and they would come and peek in the windows of the school.
Oh, my goodness.
And he would tell about that, and how the kids would be frightened when those Indian boys would come and taunt them a little bit. But He was an interesting old gentleman. Uncle Fred was very sharp right up until he died, and he had a memory that was very, very good, and used to tell many, many tales. It's too bad you never could get somebody like that on, because he was active around Grand Haven. He was very active in his church, and he was active in politics, and as was my grandfather. They were. I was told at one time that they used to trade the chairmanship every year of the Democratic Party in Grand Haven. One year Uncle Fred would be the chairman, and the next year his brother Henry would be the chairman. But they were a very patriotic family. I can remember as a boy going over to my grandfather's. And in between the old paint shop and his house, he had a great big, huge American flag always every 4th of July, Memorial Day, any holiday like that. He would fly that big flag, and it would be hanging. He had a pulley about 30 feet up,
wow.
Pulleys on between the two buildings, and he would string that flag in between those two buildings like that. And I can remember that I used to think that was such a mammoth flag. I don't know just what size it was, but I would say it was probably a good 15 feet across. It was just a great big huge American flag, but he'd always take that flag out on a holiday, and that would be flying in between those two buildings. Let's see, what else do I want to tell you? What else would you like to know here?
Well, let's start with your early childhood.
Okay, my mother was in Albers, as I mentioned, and she was born in Grand Haven. And then, let's see, I'm the second child of that marriage between Abram J. And Dorothy, or Adelaide Dorothy Albers. And my brother Russ was about 2.5 years old when I was born, and we were about that time. My dad had just had a new home built on 626 Slayton Street, so I grew up from my younger childhood. I grew up in the Slayton Street area, that was just below Slayton Street Hill, which at that time was known as Fisher's Hill. That was that was kind of our claim to fame, as we were right at the foot of the hill. And in the winter time, that was probably some of the best sliding area in the Grand Haven locality. If you go up it or down it in a car right now, it doesn't look like much, but to us as little kids, that was just a great sliding hill. We used to have some bobsleds in there. We would ice down the street because there wasn't much traffic then. And we would take and make a path right down through the center of the street, and we would ice it down in good cold weather. And we could run bobsleds down and regular sleds down there, and you could go down Slayton Street Hill, and if you were really good and had real good slick runners, well, you could run all the way across 7th Street and down in behind the Baker Lumber Company, which was there at that time too, all the way down to the railroad tracks. And we would ice a lot of that down, just carrying buckets of water out in extremely cold weather. But we used to have a lot of fun and worked hard to make good slide down there. Usually right after we got a real good slide made, then we'd have our January thaw and it would be done for the year. But we had a lot of fun. One of the last bobsleds we had was one that I got from my uncle. My mother's younger brother had a beautiful bobsled about 14, 15 feet long. It was one of them that used to bobsled down 2nd Street Hill. And if you look at Lake Avenue and the 2nd Street Hill, they would slide down that one, bobsleds, and they would go all the way down to Fulton Street area and have, of course, that was earlier times when there were hardly any automobiles and only horse-drawn sleighs and carts at that time, and buggies. But the that bobsled was, we had it for about 4 or 5 years and used to put maybe about 10-15 kids on that and go down that Slayton Street Hill in that bobsled. That was some of our fun.
That neighborhood thing to do,
yeah.
Then?
And then the other area where we just had a lot of fun as kids, because of the location of our house, it was really almost the south end of town at that time. There were several homes built out Sheldon Road in the 30s. But in our area there, Grant Street was about the last street, and then that whole area where the high school is now, that was all a big sand dune and a big hill, and it was called Green Hill at that time. Green Hill Field was down below that hill. It was kind of a flatland area down near the railroad tracks, where the football field is now. But where the tennis courts are for the high school at the present time, that was our sandlot, baseball, football, any kind of fun we wanted to have. That pretty much the neighborhood kids that lived around the South 7th Street area, that was kind of our fun playground. And kids from all over town came to that area as kind of just a, it wasn't a organized playground at all. It was just a wonderful place for kids to grow up and have fun, you know.
Good. How did you get there?
Well, we were only a block from there.
Oh, okay.
That was practically the end of Grand Haven right there, except for out Sheldon Road and up a few streets. There were a few streets up from Sheldon Road then. But Colfax was okay. About one block long. There were some houses up in there. But mostly that was all sand blow up there and quite a high dune. Again, another good place for sliding, skiing, just a lot of fun in different seasons. In the summertime, as kids, about once a week, Mom would pack us a lunch and other neighborhood mothers would pack their kids' lunches. We'd put our Boy Scout knapsacks on our backs and we'd go on a hike, and maybe we'd be gone all day, you know, we'd be just go for a whole day, and we'd be out south of town, maybe sometimes only 3-4 blocks away from home, but we thought we were a long ways out. But we could go as far as we wanted. We'd hike out to Rosy Mound sometimes. That would be a relatively long hike for us, if we, you know. But that's the kind of fun we had as kids. We made our own fun. We had our own sandlot football, and probably one of the greatest experiences I had as a little, I was a little fella. But one time I fell just right on Johnny Vinn's leg and broke his leg, and I was probably known as one of the tougher kids in town at that time. for about 2-3 days I was known as that. But I can remember the experience of breaking Johnny Vinn's leg, and that was something. Not too often did anybody really get hurt by the way we played football. We all had makeshift equipment.
How did you get him home? Did y'all carry him home? Or?
I don't remember. I think somebody ran and got one of the neighbors, somebody took him home.
Did doctor come to his house?
I don't know. I couldn't tell you.
Did they usually make house calls?
Oh, yeah. Our family doctor was Dr. DeWitt. And, in fact, my middle name, I'm named after Dr. DeWitt. Mm-hmm. He was the one the doctor was my mother's physician when I was born, and my second name is named after him. And Dr. DeWitt, yeah, I can remember him coming to our house. Sure, doctors made house calls, and there was nothing strange about that.
That was about the early 20s?
Yeah, during the 20s. Mm-hmm. I think all... Not the early 20s, the early 30s.
Early 30s.
Yeah. But sure, doctors made house calls, and I can remember one time I was hit by a BB in the eye, and my folks were quite concerned about my eye, and my dad and I walked across the field to Dr. DeWitt's house. He lived just a block away on Penoyer, and that was a late afternoon or evening visit right at his house. Well, then he looked at my eye and said there was nothing really bad with it, but it would just be bloodshot and sore for a while. But
how did you play? You had BB guns? And you played
We got into a little activities that we shouldn't have gotten into. But
how did you get a hold of the doctor without, you didn't have telephone?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we had phones.
Oh, you did? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we had telephones.
Okay.
The ones that stood up about a foot high.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And what kind of transportation did you have?
Transportation. Our family never had an automobile until I was probably maybe 12 years old, probably. It was before my dad bought a Model A Ford. It wasn't a new one. It was a used one. That was our first car. My dad used to walk to work every day and would be home for lunch every day. And we lived on South, just on Slayton, off South 7th Street. And he had to walk all the way to the north end of town, to as far as you could go, just about to the river, to the office at Date Corporation. And he walked that every day. There was just no other transportation around at that time. And we never had a necessity then to own an automobile. And I guess we never thought cars were necessary until you had your first one. But sure, every Sunday morning, Mom would get us all cleaned up, and there were three of us kids, and we'd all get cleaned up, and then we'd walk to church. Rain, sleet, snow. I can remember walking to church some days, and we'd be half frozen by the time we'd get down to the corner of 3rd and Washington. But that was always our church down there, that first church, as we grew up. Most of our activities or social activities were centered around that church and around the school. And that it was typical of a small community in the 30s. It was your school and your church were the main centers of activity. school functions. All three of us were involved in things at school that brought the family to the school, music activities. My brother was a real good musician. My sister was a cellist. I used to play drums. From fifth grade on, I was active in some form of band activity at school, band and orchestra. And so it was, those were the centers of activity. That's pretty much where our lives centered on.
What school did you go to?
Well, I went to Central School, and one did the old one that burned down here how many years ago?
Okay.
20-some years ago. But I attended there for grade school, and then high school, and for junior high. Junior high was also in the Central School building. And then high school was on 7th Street in the old high school there. So that was walking distance, you know. That was, what, 4 or 5 blocks away from home. So that wasn't bad at all. But never, we didn't have school lunches then or anything like that, because there weren't that many kids transported into school that they had to worry about giving lunches. Everybody walked to school, and you walked home for lunch. If the few students in high school, the ones that came in from the country schools around, that eventually merged, you know, when the schools consolidated in Grand Haven, but those students, Spring Lake kids and Ferrisburg, those kids, I think the Spring Lake schools at the time when I was in high school were doing some busing. I don't know about Ferrisburg. I couldn't tell you. But the majority of those kids, if they were bused in by their local district at that time, I don't think there were buses. Not when I went to school, no. Those kids got in, either their family, fathers worked in town, or they got a ride with a neighbor.
Yeah.
And then I can remember some of the girls boarded out with families in Grand Haven. And they would work, you know, and help with the meals and help babysit and that kind of thing. And that's the way they would earn their room and board. And then probably, I think a lot of them went home on weekends. But there weren't an awful lot of those students that came in, but the ones that did were good students. There were some of our
dedicated.
Yeah, they were ones that wanted to learn and wanted to continue their high school education. But there were some girls that I knew who did board in town, room and board, and with families. And then they almost became like, you know, older daughters.
Yeah.
To those families.
Probably.
Now, busing didn't start until somewhat later than that. I don't think there were any districts that bused their kids in until later than that. It started shortly after that, probably in the 40s.
Okay.
That I don't know, would be an interesting thing to find out. When did busing start in Grand Haven?
Yeah, it would be.
Yeah.
Really. Do you think after the war?
Yeah, it was pretty. I think it was afterwards. But it'd be interesting to find out which district started busing. I think Spring Lake was probably one of the early ones. But there were a lot of those kids that were excellent students. In fact, I recall many times those kids became either the valedictorian or salutatorian. Some of the girls. They were real pretty sharp.
I noticed there were a lot more girls that were valedictorians. When I was looking through the yearbook, but
probably the fact that they cared a little bit more about their education. Yeah,
I'm just teasing.
No, that's true. I think there were. I think you're right. Even when I was teaching here, there was quite a bit of that. Well, let's see. What are the things about childhood and our activities?
So you have the barn down here.
That was probably the greatest thing that any community ever had.
What was it like on the inside?
The barn?
Yeah.
Like the inside of a big warehouse, which
really?
It was. Yeah, the barn was originally a warehouse for some of the old steamship lines that used to come into this harbor. And as the harbor traffic decreased and the necessity for that kind of storage space decreased, somebody got the brilliant idea of making it into a dance hall first. The barn was originally a dance hall. But I can remember my aunt and her then boyfriend, who eventually became her husband, used to go to some of those dances there, and they used to talk about them. She would be a babysitter for us. But when the barn was purchased by the Davises, and those are the people that I remember as the owners, the Davis family, it was a mother and father and their son, ran that place. They ran an excellent place, and they really knew what kids had, and during that time, needed for fun. It not only had a large bank curved skating rink, but it also had bowling alleys. There were duck pin alleys. That's the smaller bowling pins, about 10, 12 inches high. The price to bowl was, something that kids could afford. Sometimes when we didn't have any money, if we needed some, and they needed duck pin setters or bowling pin setters, we'd set bowling pins for half the night and earn enough money to be able to bowl a couple of lanes, to bowl for a little while. They had a real good soda fountain and refreshment stand in the back. As far as I know, I think they strictly forbid any kind of alcoholic beverages if they determine anybody had been drinking and was in their... They had a very nice way of removing them from the place, and young Joe Davis was an awful big fella, and he was kind of their bouncer, although even Mom Davis, and we used to call him Mom Pa Davis, that was what we called him. They were an extremely friendly family, and I think they loved kids, I really do.
What was the drinking age then, 18?
No, it was 21.
It was 21.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, and most of the kids that hung around there, I would say majority of them, at that time, there wasn't really any great desire for anybody to get involved with alcohol. We just had some other things to do that kept us busy, and I don't recall anybody ever... saying let's go out and get some, because I just never was involved in anything like that.
Were there kids
not that
like
I opposed it or anything
in high school?
I would imagine there were a few. I don't, not very many. If there were, I never knew any kids that got themselves into any great trouble with it. It just was not a teenage problem at that time.
I see.
I don't know whether we had problems as teenagers.
Well, what, you were a teenager during the Depression. Well, the Depression was it.
But you see, everybody was in the same boat then, I think. I knew some kids in town whose families we thought were well off, but they weren't any different than we were, other than maybe they had a little nicer clothes. But most of our mothers were pretty resourceful.
I had to depend on the farmers for...
Yeah, but we... Dad had a job most of the time, and so I guess we were fortunate. There weren't any times when Dad was really laid off. They lessened his hours to some extent when Dake was really in trouble, during the Depression and didn't have many orders. But I think we were pretty fortunate. We never had a lot of money. I never felt we did, and my parents never left any great estate, other than a house. I guess that's about what we got out of it. But the Depression years, to me, the fact that everybody was kind of in the same boat and we were just kids, and Mom saw that there were 3 square meals on the table every day. I know she scrimped and saved to do that. But I can remember running over Slayton Street Hill. There was a little grocery store run by a Mr. Buttpile on Slayton Street, and my mother would send me with 10 cents, and I'd go and get 10 cents worth of hamburg. And she would usually use that to make a baked dish. The food that she put on the table was always good, wholesome food. Tuesday was always spaghetti day, I think. And we had kind of days that we knew kind of what was going to come on the table that evening, for the evening dinner, or for the noon dinner. Our noon dinners were mainly the main meal, I think, as I recall it. Most of our noon meals were the main meal. But mothers were pretty resourceful during that time, and they saw to it. And then Dad had a pretty good-sized garden out in the backyard.
Yeah.
And he grew some of the vegetables that we needed. And I remember my mother used to can furiously in the fall, late summer and fall, putting up tomatoes, they even used to put up eggs sometimes. When eggs were a little cheaper, they would buy a lot of them. My mother used to pickle them in big, huge crocks.
Yeah.
I never liked them after that.
I've never heard of a pickle.
I think Mother would cook them. I think she would hard boil them or soft boil them, and then they would put them in these crocks to keep them.
Oh.
Yeah. And I think she had a crock down there. I can remember it was about 18 inches around, and it was full of a very gooey substance, almost like cornstarch in it.
Oh.
And the eggs were kept in there. If you want to get eggs out, you had to dig down into that stuff and get them. I never liked them. I didn't like eggs that much anyway, I guess, but... Mother canned and, gosh, good. In fact, I used to go downstairs and break open a pint can jar of some of her pears. I loved her pears that she used to can. And a couple times I got caught doing that because I would open up a can and then put the cover back on, thinking she'd never know, and that, of course, they would spoil in about a week's time. And that's the way Mother knew that one of us had been digging into the fruit jars. But that fruit cellar was always full in the wintertime. And there was a lot of good food in there, you know, canned vegetables, canned beans, canned peas, everything else. She put up everything she could. So that's pretty much the way we saw to it that we ate, and on a very limited budget.
So you don't feel scarred or anything?
No. No.
Make you neurotic?
I don't think, of course, I look at what psychologists do today with kids, and they say, well, you know, this kid is reacting or acting out for some reason because of something that happened during his childhood. The great majority of us as kids did not have problems and make, you know, to where they could say these are some of the reasons that you're doing what you're doing. I think it made good, honest, hard-working people out of us, the Depression did.
Yeah.
And I think it made us appreciate what we have and what we gained. As I look back at my father, he was a hard worker, but the fact that there wasn't much around and there was very seldom extra money around made us really appreciate what we did get. When my mother would give us our allowance for the week, and it used to, I can remember when it was a nickel.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a sweet tooth. My first thing I did was with that nickel was to take off from the house, and I would practically run all the way down to Washington and 7th to Presley's drugstore and buy a Butterfinger candy bar, which at that time were about 12 inches long for
gosh.
A nickel. And then I would come back with that candy bar, and then I would give it to my mother, and she would cut it in 7 pieces so that I would have one piece of Butterfinger candy bar every day of that next week.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, she trained me to do that, I think. That was a method of savings that my mother taught me, just with a nickel candy bar. That if you eat it all now, which I could have done, it's going to be gone, you know. And so each day she would allot me one piece of that Butterfinger candy bar, and she would keep it in the icebox.
About how long in inches? About
Those Butterfingers, when they first came out, were almost 12 inches long.
Okay.
And they were about that wide, you know. They stood about that, huh? They were a big, huge candy bar. Some of those...
good.
Some of those...
They're nickel, too.
Yeah. Every once in a while, you'll see a chocolate bar made or a candy bar made in its original size, but the darn things cost you about 60, 70 cents now. The ones that we used to buy for nickel, you know?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. It's that much difference in what the cost of sugar was. And,
yeah. But then, you know, the economy.
Yeah.
Inflation. And
but those are some of the things that I can recall as a kid, you know, that we had a lot of fun. Grand Haven was a good place to grow up. With the beach, we would ride our bicycles out to the beach during hot weather like this right now. We would be going out to the beach, or we might take a cane pole and pail, a 10-quart pail. I know I always took a 10-quart pail. Some kids took these 5-gallon buckets, but I couldn't carry them if they were full of perch. Mm-hmm. But we would go out on the pier when we'd hear that the perch were biting, and we would go out on the pier and fish probably 3-4 hours in the morning and maybe catch 50, 75 to 100 perch.
You didn't have to worry about eating.
No. That was a real good meal. Another good meal that we always had, and it was really a delicacy, even after my grandfather's fishing business went belly up, he would hang around where the tugs were coming in down at the foot of Clinton Street, and he would go down there, and when the tugs would come in, one of the things they were supposed to do by law is any undersized trout that they caught, the young ones, they were supposed to give them to the jail and to some charity, you know. They were supposed to bring those fish there. But there were so many of them sometimes. And then my grandfather would wrap them up in a newspaper and carry them all the way over to our house. He'd come over to our house. And I can remember him sitting out on the back porch, and he would be cleaning lake trout, undersized lake trout. And I was practically raised on those things, because those were good eating, you know, about 12 inch trout like that. Well, that was good eating, and I still love it. We used to get a lot of fish that way with the fishing business when the fish were really plentiful in Lake Michigan, and they were doing a lot of fishing out of this harbor yet.
Yeah,
we could eat fish quite cheaply.
I didn't want to know.
Dad, having, you know, working down at Dake's just across, just up a half a block from Dake's, was the Dorn Boss fishery business. And my dad would go up there and pick up fish at a pretty good price. You could buy it right there as they were bringing it in off the, you know, it was coming in from the tugs. And Dad would pick up fish. He'd pick up smoked fish a lot. We used to eat a lot of smoked fish, smoked chubs.
Yeah.
But,
did you feel about the summer people that came and see the Highland Park?
Never bothered us. In fact, we...
So you never really got to know them?
Knew some of them. I used to meet kids out on the beach that were with families that came from St. Louis or from Chicago, Grand Rapids. And, I got to know some of those kids. Never established any great friendships, other than a couple of girls that I met. I used to date one quite frequently when she was here, and then also as I grew a little older, you know, got out into high school years, I was quite familiar with one girl I met. I also knew her through the music and playing with the orchestra here in Grand Haven, and then I started playing with the West Shore Symphony when I was a sophomore in high school. I was playing timpani with the West Shore Symphony, and then also played with the Grand Rapids Junior Symphony. And that, I guess that's the way I really got acquainted with this girl, but her folks owned a cottage up on St. Louis Ridge. And so that became quite a friendship for quite a while, till I was in the service. And then we quit writing each other, but we saw quite a bit of each other. But hadn't seen her for 40 years, and I bumped into her in Bradenton, Florida, of all places.
Really?
About 2 years ago, yeah.
What a coincidence. But,
I had my name and my picture was in the Bradenton Herald in a special little article they had about our park down there. And she spotted that article, and she called me up and asked me if I was the Harold Fisher from Grand Haven that used to be in the Air Force, and I said, I recognized the voice, and then she said, are you the one that also played in the Grand Rapids Junior Symphony? And I said, Marianne, where have you been?
Oh,
yeah, she was a nice girl, a very nice girl. And we got a chance to get together and meet down there. But she and her husband, they live in Hamilton, Ontario now, of all places. And and she and her husband have a place in
Florida.
In Bradenton, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they come down there winters the same as we do. Let's see, what else did I do?
After high school, did you go directly into the service?
Not directly. Mm-hmm. My first job was, you mentioned you were on a co-op program here, and my first job was a co-op job at Vintal Hardware on 7th Street. And I worked there as a teenage boy for about 2.5-3 years. And then after high school, I stayed there until the following February, and then went into the Air Force. And I became a pilot in the Air Force and spent 3 years in the service till the end of the war and got out. I did nothing spectacular in the service other than worked, was a pilot. And we were flying bombardier trainees around in Texas and West Texas. So that was pretty much the extent of my stint in the service. I didn't get into any combat other than the Battle of West Texas, but that's that was another battle. But after I got out of the service, I went back to Vintal Hardware for a short time. And didn't feel as there was any future there, and then I worked for a little factory in Grand Haven as a sheet metal layout worker. I did that for probably about 6 months, and had a very wise uncle, my uncle Nels, who had the coal dock down where Bicentennial Park is now. I went down to see him one day and told him I didn't like what I was doing, didn't like my job, and I didn't know what I was going to do, you know. And he was an ex-sergeant in the National Guard, and he started treating me like a rookie, and he told me I was a darn fool. Here I had a college education that the government would pay for on a GI Bill, and that I was foolish for not going. And he talked me into trying out college. I didn't think I wanted to go to college, but he talked me into going to college, and I said, well, the nearest one was Hope College. So I picked Hope College and got enrolled there, and I found out I could get good grades, which I was an average student in high school. I always felt myself as an average student. But I had matured with the service and everything else, and when I got in college, I found out I could get A's, you know, and I found out I kind of liked it. So I stayed there. I told my uncle I would go for 1 year just to satisfy him. And I ended up finishing college in 3 years.
Wow.
And so I got through and went into teaching, which surprised me more than anybody else, I guess. But
what did you specialize in?
I was a math teacher. And I first year I taught in Otsego, Michigan, and then my father indicated that he called me one night and said, there's a article in the paper saying they need a math teacher in Grand Haven. And so I put an application in, and it was accepted. At that time, Grand Haven was pretty well known for trying to hire local students. I came in just a little bit before Gene Rothy and then Don Constant, some of those people who were excellent teachers here. and very successful coaches, you know. But they did, those are all local boys. You know, we were, there was a whole group of local, locally raised young men and some women too that that they hired around that period of time. And I stayed here on the Grand Haven faculty for 12 years.
When did you live with your parents during the first?
No, because I got married when I was a senior in college.
Okay.
Married my wife Joyce, who was also a local girl.
Did you meet her at Oakley?
No. I tell you, the first time I met her was in one of the old operettas that they used to put on with the grade school kids. I didn't meet her then, but I saw her then, and I always thought she was kind of cute. And I met her at one of the tannery dances. Those were some other activities that we used to have around here. Yeah, the tannery had, the Eagle Auto Leather Company had a big gymnasium. They used to have quite active athletic teams. Baseball, the tannery had baseball teams and basketball teams. And they had a very strong program for their employees. And they recruited some of their employees. They used to hire some good basketball stars from Grand Haven, that kind of thing, and baseball players. They'd let them play on their baseball team, but they also let them work, you know, and they paid them while they were working, of course. They even built a beautiful gymnasium, and that building still stands. It's part of the factory. But it's the building right at the corner of Fulton and Beach Street that sticks out towards their parking lot. And that was a big gym. That was a beautiful gymnasium. It had a beautiful floor on it. When they got into, I think through some difficulties with union activities and this kind of thing, some of those privileges that they had in the gymnasium and those kinds of things kind of disappeared. Mm-hmm. But that gymnasium, during the summer months, they used to have a lot of bands, even some big-name bands, out at the Fruitport Pavilion, which was at the way at the upper end of Spring Lake. And there was a big, huge pavilion up there. And that, for years and years, was a good dance hall in the summertime. Well, then Frank Lockage from Muskegon Heights, he owned the Lockage Men's Store in Muskegon Heights. He was a violin player, but he had a band, and it was the big-name band that preceded Bob Warner's big-name band, because Bob used to play with him. And Bob was an arranger for Frank. A lot of Frank's music that he played. Played trumpet for him. But there were some very good musicians, and they formed a big band. And that band not only played at Fruitport in the summer, but then they would come to Grand Haven every Saturday night and play at the tannery. And that's where I met Joyce. To answer a question a long way around. But, but those also were some activities that we had as teenagers. And well-run dance halls. There was beer and liquor sold in both the Fruitport Pavilion and at the tannery. But in areas that were separated from anybody that was under 21, you couldn't get into those areas.
Oh, I see.
And they had men at the doors checking ID cards and that kind of thing, or checking ages, driver's license, and pretty much kept it to a clean-run establishment. We used to go to those dances, and I don't think alcohol really bothered anybody, because it was pretty well controlled. But that's where I met Joyce, and we started dating. And then in my senior year of college, we were married in January of, 1949. Yeah. Mm. Because we just celebrated our 40th wedding anniversary. Yeah, that's right. No, I got the date right. 1949. And after college, as I mentioned, I taught in Otsego, then Grand Haven for 12 years. And then I was invited by a man who was formerly at Grand Haven to come up to Northern Michigan University and work up there at Marquette, Michigan, up on the Upper Peninsula. I went up there for 3 years, took her family and moved, and it was like surgery moving from Grand Haven. But it was an opportunity, and a good opportunity, and we spent 3 years up there, and then an opportunity came up in Muskegon, and I took that job, and that's where I worked as an administrator in Muskegon, at the Muskegon Intermediate School District for about 19 years, I guess, before I retired. Took early retirement, retired at 59, and shortly after I retired, the bank wanted to buy that property that I owned on 3rd Street, and I had bought out my sister and my brother and their share of the house, and was maintaining it, and it was getting to be a bit of a job for me.
Yeah.
I had the heart problems, and I'd had a heart attack, and I was doing a lot of work on the side on that house, and so.
Imagine it was expensive too.
At about the time that I felt maybe I'd like to get rid of it, the bank wanted to buy it, and so what we did is we sold that property, and we bought a piece of property in Florida, and. That gave us a nice opportunity, so now we spend 6 months here, and in October we close this all up and empty the water out of it and turn the heat off and the gas, you know, the gas and the electricity off. Don't worry about it. We go to Florida and spend the winters down there and then come back in spring. That's the way we spend our years now. But enjoying life, playing golf.
Yeah. Sounds nice. So.
That's all I can tell you, but...
No, me, I have to... Oh, got 40 years of work at least ahead of me.
Don't worry about it, because those years go fast. The older you get, the faster they go.
I wanted to ask that as the years went on while you were still working in the high school system, how did you feel as... you know, high school kids, society, whatever, kind of got more decrepit and more drugs and alcohol. How did you deal with that?
Those things, I didn't have to deal with them as a teacher because they hadn't happened yet when I was still teaching. As that came on and became a prominent problem in the teenage era, I was an administrator in the Muskegon Intermediate School District, somewhat removed from the student population itself, so I didn't really get involved in that. I watched it happen because we raised two boys during the 60s, and it struck fairly close to home with both boys for a while. It was a new problem to us as parents, but one that I guess we coped with, because we still have the two boys, and we have 6 grandchildren, and we got through that period. But it was a tough period for kids to grow up in, and I would guess, you know, it's just as tough, if not harder, for kids to grow up today, because transportation and, you know, getting away from home is so easy now. You know, in 2 hours you can be 100 miles away from home and with no effort at all. When we grew up as kids, family was still a very important part of your whole lifestyle. Family activities, and we couldn't get very far away from home very quickly or very easily. So we always knew we were going to have to face the music if we got ourselves into trouble. Mm-hmm. And I think that's why kids during those days did not have the temptations, you know, that kids accept today. It's tough on kids today, plus the fact that you've got that box, you know, in everybody's living room and in half the bedrooms of America today. to where kids any time for 24 hours a day can flick a switch and can see the violence and all the problems of the world right in their own living room. We never had that. Even when I went in the war, into the war, you know, I never knew a Japanese. I knew a few kids who had a German background, but I never hated them.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, it was that they were in a different world, those people. And it was their world against our world, I guess. That's the way we looked at it in the service. We were kind of conditioned in the Air Force to form a very great dislike for anybody that was Japanese and anybody that was German, you know. That was easy for them to do because we really didn't know that many people who were of those, from that part of the world. Yeah. I guess I used to think the whole world was against the Dutch anyway. It was a Dutch community with a few Italians and a few other stray people in it. But we were raised in a pretty sheltered, Granny Eamon was a pretty sheltered community.
Yeah.
And for a little boy from a Midwestern town like that to go out into the world and learn to fly an airplane and, possibly be made into an instrument of war that way, it was fairly easy for them to condition us to that because we lived in such a sheltered world and didn't know anything else. You know?
Yeah.
We didn't have the access to the news that kids have today. And I see kids having to worry about what's happening in Afghanistan and what's happening in South Africa.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Kids get shackled with all those kinds of problems and they debate them in the school debates and they go into try and solving all these problems. And I can remember how shocked I was when my teenage boy began to say to me, "Dad, you know, you with all these possessions," and he pointed to our house and our cars and everything, and he said, "I don't want any of that," you know. And I didn't know quite where he was coming from. He kind of felt like I had caused all the problems of the world. He did at that time. You know,
yeah.
As his father, that generation had created him on. I didn't think I'd created any problems for him. In fact, I thought I was giving him a few opportunities. But it was very difficult. And that, you know, I guess I'm trying to show you as to how a father in our age was trying very hard to make the best life possible for his kids. And all of a sudden,
right,
his kids were saying, "Dad, you did a lousy job," you know.
Yeah.
And that was what broke down a lot of communications between fathers and children. As a teacher, I could see, and as a school administrator, I could see that happening because, you know, when my son said that to me, and he did one night after I picked him up about 2 in the morning in the wrong place, you know, we were sitting in our car out in our driveway, and he said, "I don't want all this, you know, Dad. These are the evils of the world." His nice warm bed was inside, you know.
Yeah.
And all those things that we thought we were doing for him, you know. And when he said that to me, I had to think a long time. I didn't respond to it in any way other than just listen to him, which was good, I guess. Because I didn't know what to say, so there wasn't anything to have said to him.
You really didn't know where he was coming from.
No, I didn't. And as I look back now and try and figure out what was going through his mind at that time, it was a youth who saw all these problems and then in his limited experience was trying to focus in on the people he knew who were of our generation and saying, there's one who did it, you know.
Yeah.
And my father was part of that establishment, you know. And so
the thing is, you can't blame it really on your generation, because we were your generation, we would have done the same thing, because you just don't have a lot of the knowledge.
But many people today are going through that same problem of trying to find somebody to blame for a problem, you know. They see a problem and right away, whose fault is it? How can we get to him?
Yeah.
You know? How can we get this guy to pay for his sins?
It's just easier to try and fix it.
Yeah, it would be put together and said, how can we solve the problem rather than saying, where do we find blame?
I mean, if you think about it, we came up with this magnificent material, plastic, and I'm sure that took some hard thinking. So it's going to take some just as more hard thinking to find something that will replace it.
Mm-hmm.
But people are too busy running around screaming, you know,
jail company's fault.
Right. Right. Anything like that.
Make them pay for it. So. I'll take my $1,000 right now. Yeah, this is probably one of the greatest problems of the generation that's coming along right now, is to say, you know, how can we get back to a unified approach to solving our problems and stop trying to find somebody to blame? We're in such a negative thinking society right now, where our whole political structure, and the last election is the best result, the best example of it, in the fact that the whole campaign was a negative campaign. It was never, I can do this and I can solve this problem, or, you know, our side can do this, and here is our approach that we're going to take. Instead of taking that and looking at the issues and talking about the issues, all they did was to say, the other guy isn't going to be able to do a thing for you. You know? And the other guy is not responsible. And we went in, we've had those kind of campaigns. I heard a commentator not maybe just 3-4 weeks ago that said, the sad part of it is that kind of a campaign works.
Yeah.
It was successful. And so there's going to be more of it. And you see more of it in Congress today. What are we doing? We're kind of destroying everything, you know, and all the tradition in Congress. Now, I'm not saying there isn't anything wrong there, but what they're doing is negatively they're going at trying to solve the problem by saying, here we've got another fellow that's been guilty of something, and let's get him. And then the Republicans come and get a Democrat, and the Democrats get two Republicans.
And in general, all the
and
people
they figure
voting
that's,
are going to be unsatisfied.
That's
anybody.
Right. And as the judge said to Ollie North yesterday, you don't realize the damage you did to our structure. That's probably true. You know, whether you think Ollie North was right and was as a, you know, Marine colonel was or Marine lieutenant colonel was following the orders of the commander in chief or whoever told him that the commander in chief said to do it that way, we'll probably never know. That those secrets will all come out one after we're dead, you know.
Yeah.
But We're in troubled times because we know so much, and we know so much of what goes on. Our life as teenagers was so much simpler, and life was simpler, and our life itself was so easy to get along, even with much less than what we have today. Mainly because we didn't know of all these problems that were existing. Sure, there were people on the take. When I was a teenager, you know, the local politicians probably skimmed a little off the top once in a while. I don't know. Mm-hmm. They could have. They didn't do that in Grand Haven because I was one of them for a while. But,
No, we know how you got that land in Florida.
Yeah. Sure, I got it through a property that I gained, you know. It was inherited, I guess. But, we know too much today. We know too many things, and kids know too much, and we don't have the experience to put it all together and come up with solutions. I don't know.
Sir.
How's that?
That's beautiful.
We got quarter after 11. And
comments you want to add about the community or?
No, other than the fact that it's you know, it was a great place to raise a family. For my great-grandparents, because I had some real great ancestors, you know, my parents were solid people. You know, their product was good, and my times when we were raising kids here and when I grew up as a boy, you know, it was a great town to live in for kids. And I think it's still that way. There's so many opportunities here. Just a matter of people recognizing that the opportunities are good ones. And I guess to teenagers, I would say, just because you've done something once doesn't make it old or things that you don't have to do again. You know, I guess we walked the boardwalk. 4th of July morning we walked it with some friends from Muskegon, and that was probably my 50th time on the boardwalk, you know. It's a nice place to go, and it's a nice place for families to walk, and the beach is a great place for kids to be. It's still as sandy and as beautiful as it was when I was born, and when my grandfather was born here, you know. It was a beautiful place. And it's something that's been here for so many years, and I don't see anybody trying to destroy it or take it away from us. You know, it's still there. Maybe, other than maybe Grand Rapids polluting it a little bit more than what they used to. But there again.
Find out about it more now.
There again. You know, that's been a long-standing problem, and it'll probably be a problem for a few more years until Grand Rapids determines the way they're going to solve it. But it's a nice place. It hasn't grown too rapidly. It's grown a lot since, you know, just in the years that we had left here, and when we came back, you find out how many new people are here and how many people you don't know. I used to know everybody.
You get a few Frenchies in the community.
Yeah, that's right. We don't know where they came from, but